Good afternoon. I'm going to bring the House Committee on Energy and Environment to order. Welcome, folks. We've got three different informational sessions today. We are a little bit compressed on time because of the special session, but I think we'll be able to get through them by approximately 4:45. And our first informational session is an update on our recycling market. So I'll invite Abby, Brian, Kristen, and Mike forward. Welcome. We've got about 20 minutes total for you, so we had hoped to get into a little bit more depth about what local, local jurisdictions around the state are doing around recycling, but I don't know that we'll have that chance. So maybe if you could leave us 5 minutes for questions.
Great.
And go right ahead and remember to introduce yourself for our record.
Well, thank you, Chair Helm, members of the committee. My name is Abby Badura, so I'm a legislative analyst for the Department of Environmental Quality. You invited me here today to discuss the current disruption in recycling markets. But since DEQ is only one piece of this very complicated puzzle, you agreed to let me bring a team of the real experts here. So we'll be giving you a flavor of the state experience, both from local government and the industry perspective. And then we have the City of Eugene to really kind of give us at least one deeper dive into how it's playing out locally. Before we dive into those details, I did want to remind everyone that Oregon is not running out of landfill space. We recycle to provide industry with materials to make new products. To recycle recycled commodities replace virgin materials, and therefore you have reduced environmental impacts when you use the recycled materials. You reduce energy use, create jobs, reduce pollution. In recent years, as you might have heard on the news, that Oregon and many countries, many states have relied on China to take the paper and plastic that go into your bins that are collected at the curbs and depots. And in fact, China was the world's largest importer of waste materials. We shipped to materials to China for a few different reasons, some because of the loss of local markets like paper mills. The low cost of shipping to China because of the containers that come to Oregon and then are empty, and it was cheap to send it back in those containers. And the fact, importantly, that China was really willing to take materials that had a lot of contamination in there, and that's the stuff that doesn't belong in there, whether it's garbage or non-recyclable products. But since January 1st of this year, the Chinese government banned some materials, including most plastic and mixed paper grades, and they also set an exceedingly low standard for contamination for those materials. That's collectively called the National Sword. I have a grand term. China's reasons for that change were a few. They closed some polluting mills over there where these materials were going. They wanted to improve their own markets and the poor quality of materials that they were receiving. The loss of this Chinese market continues to disrupt Oregon's recycling systems, and communities have adjusted in different ways. Some have raised rates, some have changed what they have collected, and a few have requested permission to dispose of those materials. And you'll hear all about that from some of the panelists here today. DEQ, and you specifically asked, so what's going on at the state level? What are we doing? And we've been closely following this ban of the products, given the disruptions it's causing. And together with our partners, we've worked on different possibilities for both the near-term and long-term responses to maintain recycling wherever possible. We do see this as an opportunity to review the recycling system in Oregon, to find ways to improve them and make them less susceptible to markets looking forward. So since October, we've been convening regular meetings with local governments, with processors, collectors, and trade associations to study the market changes, to coordinate our communication and messaging, to share resources, and to assist efforts through communication with the public. They've worked out some short-term responses to the current market conditions, and now mostly what we're doing is sharing updates on, like, kind of down to the nitty-gritty with each other, which has actually been a kind of a unique and very positive to get together every other week and talk about who's shipping where and what's the new market, how is it working best to communicate to our locals. We've been meeting twice a month. We're transitioning to once a month, because we're starting to look longer term. What is the future here in this? So we've brought together 13 industry and government representatives starting this month, and we're gonna be looking at what do we want our recycling system to look like here in Oregon? What kind of research do we need to do, and we're starting to do it, about which materials we should focus on for the best bang for our buck, identify where markets exist, how to sort the materials so we can get to those markets, and then we will switch to analyzing the options and look for a path forward to implement them. We'd be happy to come back to you all and report on the progress and some of the steps forward. By September, we should be a whole lot further down that road. We're also happy to find you the right local person and meet with you one-on-one about your individual communities along the way. If I may turn it to Brian Fuller, who can talk a little bit more about the recycling system.
I'm Brian Fuller, Western Region Materials Management Manager for DEQ. I'm just going to give a brief overview of the recycling system in Oregon and how the loss of the China market is impacting Oregon. The majority of our curbside material is collected via a commingled automated collection system. We don't have the blue bins anymore. We have the big roll carts. This has been great. It's yielded more participation and more tons collected, but it's also led to more contamination, more wishful recycling. I think this is recyclable. I'm going to throw it in the bin and let them figure it out. Contamination rates in Oregon are about 10 to 13%. As Abby mentioned earlier, the China standard is 0.5. The majority of Oregon's material is then trucked up to 6 material recovery facilities in Portland. These are basically sorting factories. They're heavy on labor and light on technology, mainly using people to pick material off conveyor belts and sort it into the various commodity grades. They're able to get that to about 2 to 3% contamination or garbage left in the recyclable stream. MRFs, or material recovery facilities, they used to pay $20 to $40 a ton for the recyclable material. They're now charging $100 a ton or more to accept the material. This is due to increased labor costs. They're slowing their sort lines down. They're adding labor to help clean up the material, try to better sort it, find new markets. Increased transportation costs. We've lost the cheap backhaul to China. Moving material to Vietnam or Malaysia is costing more money. And poor pricing for the materials. Oregon, the United States, is not alone. This is a worldwide issue. We have a large volume of material trying to find limited markets, driving prices down. Landfill tip fees range from $45 a ton to $95 a ton around the state. You add in transportation costs from the further out rural parts of Oregon, as numbers get worse. So the cost to recycle has exceeded the cost to landfill in much of Oregon. Oregon's opportunity to recycle law requires cities over 4,000 to provide its residents with recycling services. The law gives local governments flexibility and options to set their programs and meet their voluntary recovery goals. Oregon law also prohibits the disposal of source-separated recyclable material that's been collected for recycling. Oregon law further defines what is a recyclable material. So basically, if it costs less to recycle than it does to landfill, it's considered a recyclable material. So if a material or group of materials doesn't meet the definition of being a recyclable material, the rule prohibiting disposal of recyclable materials doesn't apply. DEQ was approached last fall about landfilling recyclable materials. Working with stakeholders, we developed a process for concurring that materials could be landfilled. We ask that you, people would check at least three end markets, make a good faith effort to move that material, show us your numbers, as recycling costs more than disposal, consult with your local governments, and if required, get their approval, and then monthly reporting to DEQ on tons and types of material disposed. We wanted to be as open and transparent about it as we could and have good data to help us make decisions as we move through this. DEQ is not telling communities to landfill their recycling, but giving them that option. When storage capacity is exceeded or markets can't be found, disposal serves as a needed pressure release valve on the system. Disposal of recyclable material is happening in Oregon. Again, it's mainly in the more rural parts of the state where landfill costs are cheap and transportation to Portland is high. We've granted 23 what we call concurrences since October, both one-time and ongoing. To date, we've disposed of 10,088 tons since October. For comparison, in 2016, Oregon recycled 1.4 million tons. Or over that same seven-month period, Oregon recycles 819,000 tons. So 1% of our overall recycling has been landfilled. About 5% of what we put in our commingled bins is heading to the landfill. So the majority of the material in Oregon is still being recycled. Abby talked a little bit about program changes. We're seeing people change what they collect. We're also seeing rate increases. Recycling's never been free. There are commodities. The price has gone up and down. They're at an all-time low, and the value of that material is often offset recycling rates. So in conclusion, we're facing challenges in recycling. It's still a valuable tool in the box that we need to maintain. Recyclable materials are commodities that compete with virgin natural resources. Prices have always fluctuated, but what we're seeing now is an unprecedented market disruption that is having impacts on recycling programs throughout the country. The market disruption is also an opportunity for DEQ to advance its 2050 vision. With the public's current interest in waste, we can try to move the focus beyond the end-of-life disposal. There are two other R's, reuse and reduce. And using life cycle analysis, we're now looking at impacts of materials throughout all phases of their life. So that'll help us, as Abby mentioned, as we're moving forward with our longer-term planning efforts to help make decisions that yield the greatest environmental benefits. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm Kristen Mitchell. I'm the Executive Director of Oregon Refuse and Recycling Association, which is a voluntary trade association of businesses that do recycling, garbage collection, processors of recyclable materials, material recovery facilities, composters, transfer stations, and landfills. So we cover the business end of this operation, and we work pretty closely in partnership with both the Department of Environmental Quality and our local governments as well, because they are part of our customers, particularly the local governments. Our situation has been helped, I think, in Oregon by the fact that we have had a state agency that has been very responsive to the fact that we are in the throes of an international market disruption that is having very difficult local effects in Oregon. And that has also been assisted by the local governments that are in charge of the programs around the state that have looked at what's happening in their communities and responded accordingly and based on what their communities wish to do. 60% of the materials of the world went to China in 2017. So when China started making signals that it was going to make changes in those markets, people started paying attention to try and figure out what that might mean. It wasn't the first time that we've heard changes from China, but the question was, is this going to be the time when it's really going to happen, now that our market had mostly moved there? So by September, we were having these conversations with the Department of Environmental Quality and our local governments about what do we do in the worst-case scenario when there is no market at all. Number of facilities around the state, Brian talked about the processors. Those six processors are members of our association, as are most of the companies that pick up your garbage and recycling. They only have a day's worth of storage. They don't have the ability to store long-term, and the effect on the materials if they do store long-term just turns them into even more expensive garbage because they've held them on site and they have other issues as well. So the department stepped up and assisted, and the group got together and started talking about the worst-case scenario, which are the concurrences that Brian referred to. And that's our short-term issue that we wanted to work through, and then looking forward into the long-term and even the mid-term, what do we do after we've gotten through the worst of it? What kinds of things can we do to move these recycling program so that they can be back on track. And once again, the department has stepped up and, as Abby mentioned, put together a steering committee that is talking about that issue overall, with a number of committees that are going to be looking specifically at things like collection, processing, market issues, and then overall whole system issues. You know, what can we do better going forward to maintain a resilient, sustainable system for Oregonians? So I really appreciate the work, and I can tell you from my review of other states around us, both to the north and south, the West Coast has been hit particularly hard because of our proximity, really, to China, and the fact that as manufacturing has moved overseas, with the biggest manufacturer in the world as well, it became the place where a number of our materials would go for the reasons that were explained. It was in some places less expensive to send things to China than it would be to ship them to Seattle, for example. So as that market made those changes, and then all of a sudden we were in this position where we no longer had the market, I think Oregon has been, while the canary in the coal mine, also the one that has been the best prepared to deal with what has happened, because we have the best system in place for our regulatory structure to let that move forward the way it needs to. So the state law sets standards and sets out what kind of goals we're going to have going forward, but the real workhorses in the program are the cities and counties that you live in and that make the decisions about what those programs are going to look like, what kind of service standards are going to be in place, what charge is going to be to the customer going forward, and then our membership is generally the one that implements those programs on behalf of the cities and counties. So when you want to talk about how things are different around the state, I probably could tell you from each of your communities what's happening in your communities now, because those are our members and those are the ones they serve. But I can tell you what we're trying to do really hard is get the message out to customers to recycle right, to only put in the bin or the cart what can truly be recycled, to stop using it as an overflow location for the people that are, you know, the scofflaws of the world that are going to put things like dog waste or kitchen garbage or things that we clearly know are not recyclable. And then I think the well-intentioned but still not helpful people that try to think, well, this has chasing arrows on the bottom of it, and I've seen it recycled at the grocery store, so I probably can put it in my bin, because the end result of that is you just make very, very expensive garbage, and you make it that much more difficult for the processors that Brian referred to get the material out. If a processor tells me they have about the ability to get 10% of what's coming out of the stream, if 9 to 13% of that is garbage, they don't even really have a shot to clear the materials into the correct bales to be marketed to the markets that we do have. So we really want to work hard on the message with customers about cleaning it up from the beginning. And we can all do a better job of that. We can all do a better job of giving feedback to customers about what needs to be done. So I'd really like to, going forward, have conversations about how to make that message a better message to customers. That's, we think, is a real key, is starting with good material and getting good material all the way through the line to the markets. So I'd be happy to answer questions for you going forward on this, but I want to pass it on to you.
Great. Thank you.
Good afternoon, and thank you. I'm Michael Wist with the City of Eugene. And following all you've heard from them, we've had to struggle with this on a local level. In Eugene, we have very limited sorting and processing capacity in the region, both us and Lane County. So what that means is our commingled recyclables tend to get dropped on a shop floor, reloaded into a truck, and then all sent up to the Portland metro area for processing. So what that means then is, you, on top of the added costs of this current situation we're in, we're incurring transportation costs, or our haulers are incurring transportation costs on an already expensive process. So with these increased costs, it's greatly impacted our haulers and their bottom line. Primarily the smaller hauling businesses who have less resources to send their commingled materials to. So with all that in consideration, Eugene has chosen, as of the first week of April, to limit what they're accepting in their commingled recycling stream. This wasn't an easy decision for us. We worked with the regional partners, Lane County, Bring, and our local haulers to make this decision. And working with them, we decided what would be best right now for Eugene and the surrounding area to limit. So primarily what we've done is removed plastic tubs. Think of like a yogurt container or something along those lines. We've removed that from recycling stream and have limited recyclable plastic bottles to simply narrow-necked drinking bottles, similar to like a soda bottle or a water bottle, something along those lines. By making it that restrictive, it allowed us to really simplify our messaging about what is acceptable, because when you start looking at different types of packaging, it just runs the gamut of what different shapes and materials and sizes are out there. And we also understood that a lot of the things we don't list as acceptable will still find their way into the recycling stream. We also communicated that when in doubt, throw it out if you don't have the time to find out, because that will help reduce some of the wishful recycling. We've been saying a lot locally that it seems like a lot of people had two garbage bins and just one that they felt better about putting things into. We communicated this throughout Eugene using our haulers to directly address their accounts, but also through social media, our local media, who we have a pretty solid relationship with, including radio, television, and print. We've done commercials to kind of help people sort what is and what isn't recyclable in the current situation. And we've done a number of video recordings. I've been on air a few times with different types of recyclables just to help people through that process. As one can imagine, the response has been definitely trending towards disappointment. We understand that. A lot of people, we're still getting phone calls 7 weeks later, or 6 weeks later, with people wondering what they can do to help, you know, what their responsibility are, and what the outlook is for the short and long term. One thing our approach has kind of been pulling the Band-Aid off to this issue, but one thing we've uncovered is the depth of misconceptions around what is acceptable in our curbside recycling and what isn't. Just through a number of the responses we've had, it's apparent that a lot of people just did not know what it is that should go in recycling. If it looked plastic, a lot of it was ending up in there. Many of the conversations I've had have been correcting previously existing misconceptions, and has very little to do with the changes we've made. But it also reinforces the fact that our current educational materials and marketing weren't doing the job to begin with. So we're walking away with that. We've already been in development of a large-scale recycling and solid waste educational campaign, and this has really helped to inform what our messaging should be with that once we do roll it out. And moving forward, where we're taking all the feedback we get about the misconceptions and working with our residents and our haulers to develop, like I said, a large scale addressing this issue and helping keep people informed about what the long-term outlook looks for our community. Thank you.
Great. Thank you all. We're running a little bit behind committee. If there's any burning questions?
I have one burning question.
Representative Finley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With the loss of the ability to recycle, in Eastern Oregon, there are landfills that have a tonnage limit that will only allow certain amount of tons per day. And with the loss of the ability to recycle, they're meeting or exceeding that limitation. Is there going to be any relaxation of the daily tonnage limit and or as well as the requirement to recycle X amount of your total tonnage?
Chair Helm, Representative Finley, that's a federal law, the very small landfill law, so I don't know that Oregon has the ability to change that, but that's an excellent point and something we'll take a look at and do what we can to make sure that works out correctly.
The recycle law, can I just...
Yes. No,
the tonnage is, but how about the recycle stuff? Because I'm under the impression that we're supposed to recycle 25%.
Okay.
And realize those are goals, but sometimes if you don't meet goals, you get frapped and yelled at a lot.
Those are voluntary, aspirational goals. There are no consequences if the goals are not met.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Reske.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What are other states doing? We're not in this process alone, obviously. So is there a state out there, maybe California or Idaho or Arizona? What are other states doing with this same issue?
Mr. Chair, Representative Helm, I'm most familiar with the West Coast states, and I would say that Washington stepped up about the same time that Oregon did, recognizing the severity of the issue. And they are kind of in the throes of sort of following the same procedure that we are in Oregon right now. They don't have the same regulatory system in place, so it's a little more difficult for them to make the changes as we have in Oregon to respond. But they are working in the same way, and I would say that California is kind of last to the party with, you know, the biggest group down there. They are also in the same position now of having the same conversations about how they need to go forward, what they need to do in order to continue to recycle what they can. Everyone is making efforts to continue their recycling, and so what happens when China closes the door is you open up other markets in other areas. In fact, even China is moving its facilities to different areas in the region. But what happens is it becomes more difficult to find those markets because the shipping lanes aren't the same, right? You have the manufacturing flowing back here, but those shipping containers don't go straight back to China. So as you continue to look for different markets, it becomes more difficult to find them, which is why it continues to rise. So we were sort of surprised that it frankly took as long for California to come in and say, yeah, we recognize the problem. But, you know, I'm not an expert in how their laws work. I just know it's a different situation down there. So I would say we're all in the same boat. And by the way, I talk about the West Coast and we talk about the United States, but it is truly a worldwide issue. I mean, I know I've seen press on it out of the New York Times from what's happening in London and what's going on there, and the same is with Australia. So the world is all stepping back and trying to figure out how to move forward.
I'm going to thank the four of you. Thanks for this update. It's very valuable for us. Thanks. Next committee, we're going to have a presentation on irrigation district modernization efforts. And I'll invite April, Jed, and Julie on up. Say that I preferred last week's location over this week's. We are, so Representative Bonham and myself, among others, we had Representative Lewis and Representative Helfrich were in the Hood River Valley last week about this time taking a tour of did we get all three of them? We had representatives from all three irrigation districts in the valley, and with some facilities on at least all of them. It's a beautiful day out there. Go ahead, whoever's ready first, in whichever order.
Thank you. Chair Helm, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Jed Jorgensen. I work with Energy Trust of Oregon. We really appreciate the opportunity to be here today with Julie O'Shea of Farmers Conservation Alliance and April Snell of the Oregon Water Resources Congress to give some background into the way we leverage our energy programs to help modernize Oregon's agricultural infrastructure, benefiting farmers, rural communities, the state's utility system, and our environment. As this year's below normal snowpack recedes and concerns about water levels in our rivers grows, it becomes increasingly clear that this work is relevant for irrigators in your districts, or not just for the irrigators in your districts, but indeed for all Oregonians. I'm going to start off by giving some background information into the challenges that our agricultural communities manage with their current infrastructure and give a brief overview of what irrigation modernization means for those of you who haven't had the chance to be out on a tour of these districts yet. This will dive into the benefits that can be achieved, which is really the link back to why Energy Trust and many other agencies and organizations care about this work. From there, Julie and April will talk about their roles and insights. And one quick note, the photo you see here is from an irrigation district, I believe in Central Oregon, and I think that's a 10-foot pipe that you're looking at in terms of the scale of the infrastructure that I'm going to be showing later with some illustrations. So as a quick reminder, Energy Trust is an independent nonprofit serving the customers of five investor-owned utilities here in Oregon. About 90% of our budget is dedicated to energy efficiency work with residential, commercial, and industrial customers, helping them to save energy and money. And about 10% of our budget is dedicated to helping electric utility customers generate their own energy through small distributed renewable energy projects. Our renewables team has deep expertise in distributed renewable energy generation across solar, hydro, biogas, and other technologies. And each year, we enable the installation of over 1,000 solar photovoltaic systems, and we directly support dozens of non-solar project proponents as they begin and navigate complex development processes. Through our experience, we've learned how to help projects be successful and how to avoid and overcome the barriers that can hinder project success. So, circling back to irrigation modernization, food production consumes about 80% of the water used in our increasingly drought-affected state. Up to half of that water, so half of the 80% of water that's diverted from our rivers, is seeping into the ground or evaporating before it's reaching a farm. Oregon's 6,500 farms typically receive water through canals managed by local irrigation districts. The canals transport more than 480 billion gallons of water annually, but the systems are deteriorating. Many of them are over 100 years old, and they're inherently inefficient. The challenge is that this antiquated equipment is burdening irrigation districts with high operation and maintenance costs and liability risks in the form of flooding and accidental drownings. Older diversions from the rivers and their fish screens can also cause problems for critical fish populations and the environment. I'm going to walk through what this equipment looks like. Typically, water is diverted from a river and filtered through a fish screen as it flows into an irrigation district's open canal. The amount of water is controlled manually with what's known as a head gate. Earthen canals can lose 20 to 50% of their water. So during drought years, neither farms nor rivers are getting as much as they need. Open canals also make it hard to stop contaminants from entering the water supply, which affects both farmers and water quality in our rivers. Additional manual gates move water into smaller lateral canals. Farms pump water out of the laterals, and pumping is energy intensive and expensive. In open canal systems, districts divert additional water, called end spill, to ensure that there's enough to flow past the last farm's pump. Here, a wheel line is being used to water crops. Wheel lines can lose up to 30% of their water through leaks or worn nozzles. Farmers also have to schedule their water deliveries on a calendar basis, regardless of crop need. And the irrigation district staff have to operate gates throughout the district every day to move water between laterals so that it is available on the schedule. We're working to develop a comprehensive solution to these challenges. Modernizing an irrigation system starts by replacing the open canals with replacing them with pipes, conserving the water previously lost to seepage and evaporation. Because canals were laid so that gravity moved the water, gravity will also pressurize the water when it's put in a pipe. This enables farmers to eliminate pumps, saving energy and related costs. And where there is surplus water pressure from gravity, we can produce what's known as conduit hydropower, with no impacts to fish, producing local energy resources in rural communities, and a new source of revenue for irrigation districts. The conduit hydropower and the energy savings from pump removal are the reasons why Energy Trust is focused on and investing in these projects. At the same time, our programs are helping to accelerate progress in achieving many other state policy goals. So let's walk through a modernized system. Where appropriate, modifying or removing diversion dams can enable fish to move freely up and down rivers to spawn. Water is diverted with an automated head gate through a fish screen and into a pipe, reducing operating expenses and increasing fish protection. And Chair Helm, I think you may have seen a fish screen like this last year if you went on a tour of the Three Sisters Irrigation District. Underground pipes, as I mentioned, eliminate water losses. The pipe water is pressurized by gravity or, if needed, depending on the topography, a central pumping station. Piping can also prevent contaminants from entering the water. Secondary pipes carry water to farms and ranches. Automated valves maintain optimal water pressure, eliminating the need for costly individual farm pumps. Surplus gravity pressure can be harnessed as conduit hydropower. and a cap at the end of each pipe eliminates end spills. At the farm, soil sensors can determine when and how much to irrigate. Because the water supply is pressurized and available all the time, farms can water when needed, not just on a calendar schedule. And powered by water pressure, in this picture, an automated 90% efficient center pivot system saves time, energy, and additional water. I've flown through this, but the benefits that we've identified, which Julie will go into in specifics for Oregon, are really pretty staggering. Eliminating water losses enables more water to be left in both in rivers and delivered to farms, improving drought resilience. River water temperatures can be improved and stream reaches can be restored. Pressurized water saves energy and money by taking pumps offline, enabling on-farm upgrades that save additional water, encourage reinvestment, and the production of higher value crops. When fires strike, pressurized irrigation pipes can, and as recently as last year with the Eagle Creek fire, have been tapped by wildland firefighters to fill their tanker trucks. Conduit hydropower creates a revenue stream that can help pay for these large irrigation projects, infrastructure projects. Again, Chair Helm, members of the committee, thank you very much for the invitation to speak here this afternoon. From here, Julie will provide some information on the work that's been accomplished so far here in Oregon and the specific benefits that our program has identified and we hope will soon start delivering.
Thank you, Chair Helm and the committee, for letting us be here today. Building off Jed's story, I get to tell an example of some of the work that's been happening throughout Oregon, and it's really exciting, some of the progress that we've been making. So my name is Julie Davies O'Shea. I'm the Executive Director of Farmers Conservation Alliance. And FCA began in 2005 because of the Farmers Irrigation District in Hood River. Farmers Irrigation District invented the fish screen technology that's up here right now and that Jed was talking about previously. And this technology allows fish to be able to move into the system without getting trapped. But the reverse of that is also that if a fish can get trapped, so can sticks and leaves and debris. And so it was an issue that irrigators were struggling with, that their systems were getting clogged. So this one technology solved an environmental issue and an agricultural issue. We got our start in 2006, and we started moving forward to get a federal approval on our fish screen technology because our screen is connects in with endangered species. And we had 7 fun years of working through our federal approval and sending staff throughout the Western United States to meet with other irrigators and farmers to learn more about who needed these fish screens and about irrigation infrastructure in general and what the needs were. When we finally got our approval, we were super excited. We were the first ever to get an approval from National Marine Fisheries. We also had a list of more than 150 projects. So we thought, great, we have our approval. We're going to go start putting screens in the ground. And as we went back and met with the irrigators, we did put a number of the screens in the ground, but not as many as we expected. And as we started having conversations with these irrigators, what we realized was a bigger issue was that we were trying to put our screen in systems that were 75 to 100 years old. So when you go to put the screen in, a modern piece of technology, you start opening this Pandora's box of pipes and connections and permits and other projects needing funding that was preventing us from being able to accelerate getting the technology into the ground. And so in trying to come up with ways to figure out how we could get more screens in the ground, we started talking to a number of other partners. We met with all the agencies who we had already been working with, but trying to brainstorm strategies. We were talking with nonprofits both here in Oregon and nationally, working with OWRC and Energy Trust of Oregon, having the conversation about how do we get more infrastructure in the ground, because overall we knew that every time it went in, we could create a win for irrigation, we can create a win for environment, and we can create a significant win in economic development and job creation. So in our conversations with Energy Trust, we realized that what we really needed to do was have an organization that irrigators were supportive of that could work with irrigation districts and take the lessons learned from one district and apply it to other districts and create a methodology and a system to help accelerate irrigation modernization. So we partnered with Energy Trust of Oregon, and they agreed not only to help us fund the program, but also to provide financing to support those modernization strategies with districts in Oregon. We got our start about 3 years ago. We expected 4 districts to sign up. We had 12. And today we have 18 districts in our program with roughly another 23 pending, 24 somewhere in there pending right now. And in just these 3 years, we've seen a tremendous amount of progress. In the first 8 districts that signed up into the program, we've been part of a team that's helped secure $50 million through NRCS on the PL 566 program. And the benefits of that funding is pretty significant. In the first $25 million alone, which projects we're hoping to start construction this fall on, we'll be able to put 42 CFS back in stream in the Deschutes River and be able to install 13 miles of pipe. And that's just the first $25 million. And what we're really focusing on right now is these funds were provided with a requirement to have a 25% match. Traditionally, what we would do is work with districts on assessment fees and also looking at in conduit hydro as an opportunity to be able to match that. But as that's not an option as much anymore because of the rates, we've been looking at other funds from both state, local, and trying to come up with other creative solutions to be able to match these dollars. Because being able to demonstrate that we can use these dollars and have impact makes us more competitive for being able to secure more dollars. And in the sheet we passed out, you can see the scale of impact. So that sheet right there shows you just the collective impact in modernizing 9 irrigation districts. Those are the ones we have the numbers on right now. And modernizing those districts would put 550 CFS in stream. It opened 208 miles for safe fish passage. It support the generation of 38 megawatts of renewable energy. And it would support 20,000 jobs in rural Oregon. It's a tremendous impact. And when you start thinking about this, that's just a handful of districts. When you start thinking about that impact across the state and across our nation, it's a really big deal. And especially when you think about our population is projected to double in the next 30 years, and only 2% of our population farms, and they're farming with systems that are 75 to 100 years old, modernizing these systems is critical for having food security, increasing agricultural production, yet at the same time improving the environment through water quality and quantity, improving habitat, and then from a community perspective, economic development and job creation. Thank you for your time.
We had some slides we missed.
Thank you. As we're going through the additional slides there, for the record, April Snell, Executive Director of the Oregon Water Resources Congress. Thank you very much for your time today. And the good thing is I know we're running behind, and so I won't take a bunch of time, but Jed and Julie just gave you a great overview that hopefully will leave you wanting to know more about irrigation modernization. But OWRC is the statewide association that represents irrigation districts and other similar entities around the state. We work closely with entities like Energy Trust and Farmers Conservation to try and provide benefits to our members who serve farmers and other water users around the state. So this map here, which you can't see the names on it very clearly, but it just gives you an idea of where our members are around the state. So everywhere you see the white writing, that's one of our members, and they are all over the state, and there's many other small entities around as well. And hearkening back a little bit, here are some factoids about irrigated agriculture that I won't get into, except that, as you guys all know, water is exceptionally important to not only our agricultural economies, but our local communities and the environment we all share. If you hearken back to the previous panel, recycling, there's a fourth word in the recycling world that I think applies to what we're talking about today as well, and that is rethink. And the idea would be that in the recycling realm, there's only so much you can do to reuse and recycle. How do you change things beyond that? And similarly, for irrigated agriculture, there are a lot of different things we can do to conserve water and make systems more efficient. But in many ways, we need to rethink how we go about modernizing these systems to better demonstrate the environmental benefits that many of us within agriculture know that we're providing already. So just kind of going through here, I think it's important to be reminded of what sort of systems we're talking about here. So in the far left corner there, that's the Owyhee Dam, that's in Representative Finley's district. That's the largest dam in Oregon. It's a little under 500 feet and was the model for Hoover Dam. It's a remarkably well-built piece of infrastructure that was built in the 1930s.
I highlight that because most of the infrastructure in Oregon is 75 to 100 years or more, and the investment that built that infrastructure at the federal level is virtually non-existent, and we don't expect that to come around again. And just like our bridges and roads, the canals, dams, pipelines that convey water to farms and other important purposes need to be improved, maintained, and modernized to reflect the needs that we have today. So there are a variety of different types of irrigation districts and similar entities around the state. The important part is that, at least with the members we work with, they're special districts, they're local government entities, they're subject to public meetings and other things just like you guys are as well. And again, here's more pretty pictures to remind us of what we're talking about. Open canals, pipelines, and even that one on the left there is an open canal. A lot of different types of infrastructure and different ways to get that water to fields. Now, fish passage and fish screens, you heard Julie talk about the farmer's fish screen. When many of the infrastructure pieces that irrigators use were built, there wasn't anything called the Endangered Species Act. There was no laws, regulations about those things, let alone the mechanisms to put facilities into infrastructure to prevent fish from getting into the system or make sure that they safely pass. Now there is, and in order to install these fish screens and fish passage apparatuses, you're talking at least $1 million in most instances to put in some of these structures. That's something that for an individual group of farmers, that can be near impossible for them to do on their own. So just kind of in summing up the challenges, we've got a lot of old stuff out there that needs to be improved. The way that districts get revenue from their patrons is by assessments, which are for the operation and maintenance of their systems. And that varies around the state. It even varies between districts within the same area. Sometimes it depends on what type of crops they're growing and how much revenue they have from the farmers. But in essence, if you have a group of farmers who are just trying to make it on their own, their ability to pay more to, say, put in some really nice pipe is very limited. They may want to, but their ability to do that is very limited. And so that's why we're very excited about the work that Farmers Conservation Alliance is doing with Energy Trust to work with individual districts, help them identify the opportunities they have for improving their infrastructure, see if there's a way that they can put in-conduit hydropower in there that helps pay for matching federal funds or helps pay for a state loan, and that's very critical. The funding that Julie mentioned through NRCS, we're very hopeful that there will be additional funding that comes through at the federal level for these projects. But as Julie mentioned, they do require at least a 25% match that can't be from other federal funds. The funding and the work that the districts that are using this funding so far, it's a very robust set of requirements that come along with the funding. As an example, they have to do a watershed plan. They have to do an environmental assessment. There's a public comment period that goes along with that. I don't think you'll find a more robust set of requirements that these districts are going through to get these projects done. And so when they're looking at other sources of funding, it's really critical to make sure that those funding sources match up with the existing federal programs and don't add a whole bunch of additional requirements that could cause a district to walk away from the project. So with that, I want to leave some time for questions and hope that you guys have some questions and are excited to see what we might be able to do to help rethink and modernize our irrigation infrastructure around the state.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Representative Marsh.
Thank you. Okay, you convinced me. I'm sure that we need to modernize our systems. And I'm also assuming that one of the barriers to accelerating this kind of program is a financial one, is being able to find the original capital that you need just to do a plan to figure out what the modernization approach will be, and then to fund the capital. So I'm wondering if you could say a little bit more about how you encourage districts to braid together funding sources from different places, whether you are seeing as you look ahead, barriers to continuing the work at the level that you're doing, or opportunities to accelerate?
Chair Helm, Representative Marsh. Basically, the way that our funding works right now, we have a partnership with Energy Trust of Oregon that pays for a significant portion of the initial assessment fee, where we do a data collection, financial analysis, a system improvement plan, a modernization strategy. And then we have a second partnership with NRCS Oregon that funds writing the watershed plans and the environmental assessments and hosts that public process so that we're truly getting the districts to be shovel-ready and at that starting line. Critical to be able to expand this is identifying other partners that can help finance those initial assessment pieces. And they're really critical tools. The districts can be able to use this for a long period of time. It's very adaptable once they start construction. And it really sets up a strong project sequencing and a really clear, articulate vision and mission towards what modernization looks like in each district, because it's different depending on where you are in the state.
Jed, is ETO committed to this, able to look to the future and with a strong intention to continue this work?
Chair Helm, Representative Marsh, we are certainly committed to this work through the period while our funding is in existence. As the committee probably remembers, Energy Trust funding for renewables comes only from Senate Bill 1149, passed back in 1999. So that legislation at present would be sunsetting at the end of 2025, which means functionally from or our organization's perspective, we would need to start planning for that sunset probably in 2022, 2023, in terms of thinking about what that would mean for our programs. So through then, yes, we will remain committed. Now, as Julie mentioned, our investment has essentially been about $200,000 per irrigation district, plus some additional funding to help FCA manage the program as a whole. With the high levels of interest, we are very much bumping up against our budgetary limits within our renewable energy program. So there's a bit of a limit to how many more districts we can bring on to begin this assessment process with the funding that we have and how fast we can move that forward.
Thank you. Further questions? Representative Reschke.
And then Representative Holman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to ask the impossible question because I'm going to ask for a ballpark or estimate or average. What's the cost per mile to put in a piping system like this?
Representative Helm, Representative Reschke. I apologize.
No.
We estimate it's roughly $1 million a mile. Okay. We're working on systems to try to reduce that cost. Yeah. And so one of the things that we're really focused on right now, what's exciting about Energy Trust investment is that just like normal investment strategies, you don't want to work on one district at a time because you can never achieve scale, right? You can never get to those cost savings places. And because we're working with such a large number of districts in the state, we're trying to identify ways to be able to reduce the cost and identify programs that can help scale those pieces. So we're working on methods to help on the piping cost.
Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And following along the vein of costs, I was just seeing if I can articulate this. The issue I'm curious about is the in-conduit energy production and the sale of that to your local utilities, I would assume, because you're putting that energy back onto the grid. And I know that in the consumer-owned area that is much of our rural area, they've not been as receptive to bringing on more renewable energy since they're largely BPA-based and hydro-based, which, you know, is pretty clean, and they don't really see that need to take on more renewables is when I talk to them about renewables. And so, you know, and just it's sort of like they're not recognizing, if it is real, that we are stressed with our water resources going forward into the future with increased population, drinking water demands, you know, the increase in, you know, the growth in agriculture, you know, potentially or hopefully, that will need more water as well, and then energy production in general. And so if the BPA is really an unending source of energy, you know, what is the price that you're able to get out of a purchase agreement for the in-conduit renewable power from these co-ops? And, you know, I mean, how much money are they paying for that energy? And because that seems like a pretty important equation to work into figuring out how to make this work. And do you have any suggestions for trying to enhance that?
Yes, Chair Helm, Representative Holvey, you are correct. It is very difficult to try to sell power on, as a wholesale power provider to a utility that is purchasing power from Bonneville, because they're able to get power for 2 cents or so, 2-3 cents, and it's really hard to make a project like the conduit hydro projects that we have possible here to pencil out for that rate. What Energy Trust has done in the past, where we have had some opportunities, like with Three Sisters Irrigation District over near Sisters, they are in Central Electric Co-op territory. We were able to help them with a 700 kilowatt project that came online back in 2014. They're wheeling that power through Central Electric Co-op territory. Wheeling is the technical term for moving it through another utility's region to deliver it to Pacific Power. The wheeling, however, adds another layer of cost to get it out of that utility's territory. And those wheeling costs can be all over the map in terms of how much they add up to. So that's a challenge because there's no standardization around what those costs are. They're created by and relative to that local community's utility. The wholesale power markets for the investor-owned utilities in Oregon have also changed very significantly over the last 10 years. When we were seeing projects 5-10 years ago that were coming in, their revenues from a wholesale power purchase agreement were probably at least 50 to 100% more than are available now. And both utilities' most recent filings with the PUC to set up those wholesale power costs, we saw at the beginning of this month, very significant decreases again in proposed power prices. So the kind of the model that we started building this on as we put together this program, when we got started about 5 years ago, it was a very different power market than we find ourselves in today. In terms of suggestions, Energy Trust, I have to be very careful. Energy Trust is a entity that does not participate in lobbying and cannot advocate for or against any particular policies. However, I would say that there are a number of policies that are in effect in California to the south of us that have enabled other distributed renewable energy projects to move forward that we don't have in Oregon. Things like the California, I don't remember what the acronym stands for, but it's the RESBCT program, which essentially allows municipalities and irrigation districts are a quasi-municipal entity, but those municipalities there can essentially virtually net meter. So they can take advantage of net metering rather than wholesaling their power. And so they're offsetting their power at a retail rate, and they can aggregate all of their electric use under that program and net meter it. That is something that we have seen projects in California utilizing in order to be able to move forward.
One last quick follow-up. I'm just curious if there are projections of water resources to the future in terms of what's our current demand for energy production, agriculture, drinking water resources, and given climate change and our snowpack disappearing every year, it seems like, you know, what's the projection in the future for those demands?
Stab at that.
Thank you, Crystal Ball.
Chair Helm, Representative Holvey, thank you for the question. I would say there's a large demand would be the short answer to that. We're in the process of working with our members to try and get an updated assessment of just how many open canals there are, with the thought of then we would have a good number of, well, how much would we need to pipe all of those canals? And going a step further, if we could put hydro in some of those pipes, how would that be? But there's a lot of data out there about the growing population and how much food it's going to take globally to feed that growing population. And I think, you know, America and Oregon, we provide a lot of valuable agricultural products, and without water, none of that would be possible. And so it's something that we're trying to work on better as far as telling our story, and that's definitely an important part of the story. But we're not anticipating that we're going to be in a different climactic situation. I think the droughts that we've seen in the previous years are going to happen again and more frequently, and that's something that when you're not going to have rainfall or snowpack to provide water, it's going to cause a lot of pressures on not only irrigation but the communities and the environment that depend on it all. So I think don't have a specific answer except that we have a huge need, and it'd be great to get ahead of that before we have a crisis.
Can I have one more piece to that?
Yes, please.
Chair Helm and Representative Holvey, FCA is right now working in partnership with Oregon State University to do a study to look at production of food and how much energy and water it requires under a modernized system and an unmodernized system. We have some rough guesses, and the numbers are pretty significant, but we're hoping this July to actually have that study to be able to help communicate better about the benefits of modernization.
Representative Finley.
I have a quick question, and this is, I have several irrigation districts in my district that are actively piping and having cogeneration facilities. One issue that's an unintended consequence with the piping of the laterals is the effects on the groundwater. We're having multiple areas in my district that their groundwater wells are drying up because their canals are now no longer leaking into the ground. So is there considerations for that? I mean, this is a huge deal. I mean, the burden of proof is pretty high for people to prove.
Chair Helm and Representative Finley, that's actually a big part of what modern irrigation infrastructure is about. Initially, it was just about piping, right, and piping those canals, and we've learned a lot from that. And so what we're really focused on is intentional recharge. And so what we're doing at is looking at how do we pipe a system to ensure not only the proper amount of withdrawal, but also managing water quality issues. And then we're starting in a process right now about modeling the irrigation system and the geology to be able to look at where is the most critical for recharge efforts so we can maximize the amount of recharge. And so that is definitely part of the equation, and it's a really important question and an issue.
Thank you. Good to know that.
Just to follow up a little bit on that, Representative Finley, Chair Helm, that as Julie alluded to, different systems, different applications might be more appropriate. You know, in some instances, flood irrigation is appropriate and a healthy way of irrigating because you have those variety of benefits. In the case of the Oahe system, in essence, some people were getting well water from the canals that were artificially recharging that groundwater that wouldn't have otherwise occurred if it weren't for the irrigation project. And I think as more piping projects occur, we're going to have more issues like this. And it brings up, I think, a very pertinent issue of, you know, what are natural conditions? And what does that mean when you have people that live in an area where without the water projects, those people probably would not be living there, and now we have communities that have grown up relying on those water resources, and I think it's something that is very important to balance in the system to make sure that we're making wise use of the resource in all ways. But it is something where I think it's important that there's a plan and an understanding of where it makes the most sense to improve infrastructure, and that there may be some unintended consequences if we're not careful in that regard. Great question.
Thank you very much for bringing this information to us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Next committee, I wanted to bring some information back to the committee that that really probably belongs within the scope of our mission, but we haven't heard much of because how we approach the cannabis industry's use of energy was an issue that the Marijuana Legalization Committee sort of took control of during the 2015 session, and we developed a task force around it. And that task force did its job, and then folks have been out working with those results for a while. And I thought now's a good time to bring them back in and see what folks in the industry have been doing. And that's, you know, that doesn't have much to do with cannabis, except that it's an energy-intensive form of agriculture that may be coming back to our committee in various ways in the future. So I wanted to have this panel today. And so I'll invite Derek, and I only see one Jesse here. So Jesse, come on up. Megan and Brendan. And I know we promised you 30 minutes or 20 minutes, and I'm happy to stay until you're done, and any of my committee members that are interested are invited to stay. We should be done by 5 o'clock committee in any case.
Yeah, I think hopefully all before right. then. And Chair Helm and members of the committee, thank you again for having us. I'm Derek Smith. I just wanted to announce that Jesse Horton is on his way. Traffic is really bad. He's trying to get here. He is the connective tissue as the industry representative on the Cannabis Environmental Best Practices Task Force that made the recommendations 2 years ago. What's that? Oh, and Brendan was on there too. Excuse me. But I'm not starting today. I would ask Jesse Peters to start.
Chair Helm, members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Jesse Peters. I am a board member with the Oregon Cannabis Association, a member of the Craft Cannabis Alliance, a member of RII. I also own an indoor cultivation facility in Canby, Oregon, that's on 20 acres in 23,000 square feet. As most probably know, the cannabis industry for cultivators currently is exceptionally difficult. It is hard to stay financed, and the way to stay financed is to be exceptionally efficient. To give an idea of what it takes us to be efficient and where energy usage comes into indoor cultivation, we are the third most efficient indoor farm in the country in accordance to studies done with RII. We spend $7.81 per plant on nutrient, $11.43 per plant on labor, and $17.85 per plant on power. We use LED light. We use 100% wind power, and we have received grants from the ETO for our lighting, and for what we plan to do is put up a solar array by the end of the summer. Having a resource to be able to incentivize farmers to go to that 100% renewable energy wind power, we actually pay extra to do it. If we could see tax incentives in the industry to do such a thing, I think we could see a lot of cultivators move in that direction. Considering that there are over 900 licenses still in the queue at the OLCC to come on as cultivators, the competition in this market is not going to get any easier. That being said, having a certification system that shows our efficiency and can help drive us through the industry to be better at what we do and to be more efficient is crucial for our survival as an agricultural commodity, which is where we're going. Excuse me. That's kind of my little spiel. If anybody has any questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Great. Thank you.
Hi. Thank you, Chair Helm and members of the committee for continuing this work around sustainability in cannabis. My name is Megan Wallstatter, co-founder of Pure Green Dispensary located in Northeast Portland. I'm also a board member for the Oregon Cannabis Association. Just wanted to give some little economic stuff. It's estimated that there are over 12,500 jobs touching the cannabis industry right now in Oregon, resulting in $315 million in wages, adding $1.1 billion in economic activity in the state. And between January 2016 and August 2017, Oregon collected $108.6 million in state and local taxes from the recreational cannabis industry. My husband, Matt, and I opened Pure Green 4.5 years ago. We have navigated the medical and the recreational retail markets. The retail market is very competitive right now. We believe that creating standards for sustainability in the cannabis market will enable brands to be recognized for their efforts and allow customers to purchase products that are in alignment with their beliefs. Most retail markets within the state of Oregon have some way for brands and stores to highlight their sustainability practices. Consumers want this information, and it's part of the retail culture in Oregon. There are many third-party sustainability certifications for retail products and stores in other sectors, while nothing exists in cannabis yet. At Pure Green, we want to launch a program called Sustainable Sundays that would allow us to feature vendors and their sustainable practices. It's been very difficult to know who is doing what, and the only way for our store to compile this data is to individually email all of our vendors, and you can imagine how time-consuming that can be, and assuming that the vendors will prioritize a timely response due to their ever-increasing market pressures. If I were able to view a list that has been vetted by a reputable third party, it would facilitate my ability to highlight and promote vendors who take responsible actions towards sustainability. As a retailer, I want to know about the environmental practices of businesses from who we source products, particularly their energy and climate impacts. My customers want to know too. Personally, I want to be a leader in the retail level by showcasing sustainable products. Oregon is already viewed as a sustainability leader across the nation. This is an opportunity for the Oregon cannabis industry to continue our state's sustainable leadership and efforts. Thank you.
Chair Helm, members of the committee, again, my name is Derek Smith. I'm Executive Director of Resource Innovation Institute. We're a national nonprofit actually working throughout North America based here in Portland. Looking at and measuring the energy and other natural resource impacts of the cannabis industry and determining what is the most efficient way to move forward as individual producers. We started here in Oregon by several folks who, including an energy policy advisor for Governor Brown and Governor Kitzhaber, we have strong Oregon representation on our board from the industry as well as surrounding the industry stakeholders. We also have the California Cannabis Industry Association on our board and the American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy, which is the leading and most influential energy policy organization based in Washington, D.C. So we appreciate the leadership from members of our nonprofit, like Jesse and Megan and the other Jesse who may show up. We also appreciate PGE, the Northwest Power Council, and other energy and utility organizations serving on our technical advisory committee and advising us. We are objectively informing the industry, governments, utilities, and other key stakeholders about the energy and other natural resource impacts of this industry, and again, how to be most efficient at doing this. We are ultimately planning to launch a certification system that would be a voluntary market-based certification system that would recognize leaders like these folks who are really taking the steps. The challenge is it is incredibly hard to know what is efficient. The way this plant is cultivated is in a variety of settings, either indoor, greenhouse, outdoor, different stages of cultivation with different energy impacts. So we are establishing those standards. We are creating venues, for example, the Energy Trust. We are serving the Energy Trust to help put on events where growers can come and learn how to connect to the incentives available from Energy Trust, as Jesse mentioned he has. As well as how to automate their facility, how to do things more efficiently. We are also supporting things like a code proposal that's moving through the building codes division here in the state, which is recognizing that when this plant is produced in an indoor environment, that building should be regulated as if it is for plants and not for humans, and it actually requires a building code adjustment. So there's a lot of that is still being learned about energy impacts in cannabis, but here's a little bit about what we do know. There is a massive range of electricity usage from almost literally no grid impact from an outdoor producer downstate, as an example, to a very inefficient farm, unlike Jesse's, that is producing indoors, can have about 500 kilowatt hours per square foot. And if you concentrate those together, they can collectively have the impact of data centers. And we all have heard about the data center impact on the electricity sector here in Oregon. What we don't know is, what is baseline energy consumption? How will the market shape out? When the federal government allows cannabis legally in interstate commerce, how that will drive the illicit market out, how that will relieve or increase cost pressure, and how Oregon will compete internationally and continue to create the jobs and the tax benefits that this industry is providing to the state. Our data set will teach that. Our data set will teach how Oregon producers are comparing on terms of resource use relative to the rest of the world. So the question is really, I think, for you all is, how do you regulate or create market-based incentives to drive conservation in this chaotic industry that's the fastest growing industry and in some cases gobbling up resources? And I would just say that, in closing, Oregon has shown that carrots and sticks work well to drive conservation. Energy Trust provides great incentives and is definitely a leader in providing support for this industry and capturing a ton of energy savings from it. Oregon Department of Energy was the first state agency in the country to regulate, to require energy reporting, which is great because their data and our data is clearly showing that there is a ton of opportunity to reduce electricity consumption. So we've got a strong foundation here. Other states are beginning to regulate energy consumption by this industry. Massachusetts and California are making headways. We have the opportunity, we have a strong foundation here to develop market-based programs that can support Oregon growers to win, and Oregon to win internationally and nationally, while protecting the state's resources. And as a nonprofit organization, we're happy to help. Thank you.
Thank you. Members of the committee, Chair Helm, Brendan McCarthy, representing Portland General Electric today. I always represent Portland General Electric. I don't know if it was just today, but I feel a little bit like the oddball on the panel here. But it's interesting. You know, my history of marijuana goes back. The electrical history of marijuana goes back to about 2010 or so, when I started hearing from our energy theft division that there was a lot of indoor grows related to mostly the medical marijuana industry. And so I started a little bit of outreach to the medical marijuana community, saying, hey, you know, it'd be really helpful if you guys and us talked about your grow operation and from delivering safe and reliable power, emphasis on safe. If we know what you need, we can help size your equipment appropriately. And so we had residential grow operations that were using 12,000, 13,000 kilowatt hours a month, which for a residential service is going to make your meter turn brown and eventually going to make it go out because that's a little much. You all know Portland General Electric. We serve 877,000 customers, and we serve Salem, and we serve Portland, and we serve about 75% of the state's GDP. And we have a lot of marijuana businesses, both retail and grow operations. We have grow operations that are urban. We have grow operations that are in rural East County, Multnomah, and in Clackamas County. We serve everybody on a non-discriminatory basis, so we don't care if someone comes to us with a retail establishment that's a restaurant or a retail establishment that's a pot operation or a grow operation. We serve everybody on a non-discriminatory basis, and it serves us very well to ensure that we get good information from the growers. So we've maintained this relationship where if we know what they anticipate using, we can give them the service correctly. We have different ways of providing that service. If it's a bare ground operation, the cost is typically on them. So if someone comes to us in East Multnomah County and wants to put up a bunch of hoop houses and needs an upgrade, that typically falls, the costs fall on the grower in that case. If it's to a building, we have something called a line extension allowance, which we base upon the expected energy consumption and an expectation that energy consumption over a period of 5 years will pay back the allowance that we give them. It's important for our customers to know then that we are looking at that energy consumption appropriately. And that requires information as to the kinds of lights that they're going to use, and if they're not using LEDs, the kind of, if you're not using LEDs, your HVAC needs are greater. So we look at the machinery that's inside the building and try and put a power factor to it, and then we estimate over that period of time how much energy they're going to use. But we're learning because, as Jesse mentioned, costs are important. And so if a business starts with one idea and then as time moves on, they make their process more efficiently, more efficient, that means their consumption isn't exactly what we anticipated. Now, that's not a bad thing. That's a good thing. It's good for the overall system. But it might mean that the line extension allowance may have been a little too rich. So we're working to really dial in on what we call that combined factor. When you add up all the equipment you anticipate in that building and then figure out what that consumption is, we're at an internal process right now trying to figure out, is it right? Because this is a new business in a sense. But it is what we do, and it is not unlike any other business. That rests on that two-way communication between the business and the electric utility. And I think that's probably really about it. I mean, I think the tool that Derek's has been working on and the suggestion from the Environmental Best Practices Task Force, I mean, I think those kinds of that kind of information is crucial to getting it right. But we are very much in the dawn of this business, and when I asked before I appeared today, internally I said, how are we doing? And we said, well, the answer back was kind of like, well, we're still learning, we're still getting it right. So I said, are other customers kind of picking up the extra costs of us oversizing systems or too rich allowances? And the answer pretty firmly back was, it's way too early to make that judgment. And it seems like right now it's going pretty well. So again, free flow of information is crucial. Getting that information down and changing the way we do business is key. And then the last piece I would mention is the green power programs. They're all eligible to sign up for a voluntary green power program, and some of them do. And we just crossed 180,000 customers in that green power program. 21% of our residential customers are enrolled. Number one utility in the country on any metric. Awesome. So,
very cool. Okay. Questions from the committee?
I'll ask. Do we collectively, and do you folks that have been working with some of the data so far, do we know whether we're approaching a point at which you might want to ask either the legislature or the relevant administrative agency to set some standards or objectives for you to shoot for? It's kind of a dangerous question to ask folks that are trying to set up a third-party certification system, but
Chair Helm, members of the committee,
we've done that in the past.
Yeah, I appreciate the question. And yes, from a technical advisory committee process, we are nearing the point where we have enough data to begin to make judgments. But as Brendan said, we're not quite there yet. We don't have the large data set that will indicate how Oregon is comparing to other states. That's what really needs to happen, right? So how efficiently are Oregon producers relative to the rest of the country, relative to the rest of the world? We don't know that. We actually don't. I would say literally we have manufacturers, utilities, public agencies, top producers in multiple states, energy engineers, contractors, architects, all coming together sitting around large tables at Energy Trust and the Northwest Power Council. They host these meetings. And we're all trying to figure out what is the right combination of lighting and HVAC that actually drives the highest product produced at the lowest energy inputs. Literally nobody knows the answer to that in the world. Our data set will reveal that. We need more data in there. We appreciate the partnership with the Oregon Department of Energy to capture the data, share that with us, and we're getting it from elsewhere in the world so that we can come back and have, we believe, by late fall, enough data to set some standards and say with confidence, this is good performance and this is not. And therefore, to give the public sector and the utilities and others the ability to confidently express that if they install this equipment, they produce in this manner, they achieve these metrics, they will be the leaders in this industry, and they should be recognized, right? Anything to add on from a technical standpoint?
No, you really kind of said it all. I completely agree, and I can say at least from our end at the presentations I've given within the state and outside of the state, you can see an eagerness with companies that want to go down this path. And I do truly believe that once we have a data set to substantiate it, if we can give someone an incentivized reason to follow it, outside of the fact that what we learned was being environmentally conscious actually added to our efficiency and a compounding factor that made us to be able to cultivate substantially cheaper than everyone else. So I do think that with this data set and these tools, we could incentivize a pretty unique program to change the way we look at agriculture in general, but especially cannabis agriculture.
Representative Marsh had a question.
Thank you, yes. Mr. Chair. So as you move toward a standardization or an aspirational goals here, how do you compensate for changing inputs for various growers? For example, ETO serves 2/3 of the state. You've talked about the incentives that you've been able to receive through ETO. Across 1/3 of the state, those incentives would not be available. So how do you hold those growers, how do you compensate for that? How do you hold them to a standard when they have very different levels of support for that?
So, Chair Helm, Representative Marsh, thank you for the question. And yes, we do recognize the public utility districts like yours, that things are very, very challenging for producers there. I mean, we have a producer in Columbia County that is really trying to be as efficient as possible and can't get support because he's in a district that is served by the Bonneville Power Administration, which is obviously not involved in Oregon's regulated cannabis market. I think it's still important to set the standards and to indicate what the benchmarks are so that people know if they're performing efficiently relative to their peer set, and that's going to help them economically. Setting up a market-based standard that would be supported by the state would give their customers the ability to know that they should be preferred as a producer. And so hopefully be able to get a higher price point in a retail setting. So I think there's other benefits, even though they can't get the utility incentive dollars that may be available to someone in a investor-owned utility territory. That said, the City of Ashland's utility and other public utilities have the option to self-fund. They just can't get reimbursement from BPA for the incentives. I hope I addressed your question. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah.
And Chair Helm, Representative March, it was mentioned earlier, one of the interesting things about where the ETO serves and the growing operations in the state is there is also that geographic diversity that was mentioned earlier. A lot of the grow operations in your area are actually outside. Mm-hmm. So there's, other than the Columbia County, which would be in the wet area as well, might not be the same, but there is an interesting, at least partial overlap between the way the growers operate in the ETO area and outside.
Yeah, that's true. And Jesse Horton will officially not make it, so there was an accident.
Okay, so I'm glad that it didn't arrive here right now.
Yes, exactly.
All right, well, thank you very much. We appreciate this information, and we'll look forward to checking in again probably in 2019. And if you find this data coming together in a form that you're able to share it with us before then, please feel free to do so.
Yes, will do. Thank you very much. Thank you all.
Okay, and with that, committee, we've completed our informational sessions for the day. Anything for good of the order? All right. I will close the interim meeting of the House Committee on Energy and Environment. Thanks for being here.